Chapter 4. The Constitution was sailing northwards with a flowing sheet, helped on her way by the great current that flowed from the Gulf of Mexico, and Dr. Maturin stood at her taffrail staring at the wake, white in the indigo blue. Few things could be more favourable for the easy run of a retrospective mind, and Stevens flowed as free as the stream itself. The recent past was immediately present to his eye, his mind's or inner eye. It saw the various incidents reenacting against the background of white water, sometimes blurred and fragmentary, sometimes as sharp as an image in a camera obscura. The ferrying of all the prisoners of war across the heaving sea in the only boat left to the other side, a leaking 10-oared cutter, over 100 of them wounded. Bondon's cry of, "Why, Boston Joe!" as the American seaman, a former shipmate, put the manacles on him. The burning of the Java, the vast pall of smoke that rose over her as she blew up, the horrible journey to San Salvador in the enormously overcrowded ship on a blazing day with a lifeless following breeze, the Java's unwounded hands in irons and battened down in case they should rise upon their captors, the captors themselves furiously busy with their own repairs. The Constitution's cable tier turned into one long sick bay and many shocking wounds to deal with. It was here that he had met Mr. Evans, the Constitution's surgeon, and learnt to esteem him. A bold, deft operator with a firm mind, a man whose sole aim was to preserve life and limb, and who fought very hard to do so with great skill, learning, and devotion. A man who made no difference between his own people and the prisoners, and one of the few surgeons he had known who considered the whole man, not only the wound itself. Between them they thought they had saved Captain Lambert, although they very nearly despaired of Jack when the high fever and the look of gangrene appeared. Yet in both cases they were wrong. Lambert died the day he was carried ashore, and Jack survived, although he was too near death to be moved before the Constitution sailed. "Lambert died more of misery than of his wounds," reflected Stephen. "The third frigate to strike to the Americans. I believe it would have killed Jack in his already weakened state had he been in command. Even so, he smelt of death." He contemplated for a while upon stimuli, positive and negative, upon that which had filled the much weakened leopards with prodigious strength and activity during the battle, upon that which had struck them back to a state of extreme, listless fatigue. "He has survived, sure, and his functions are much what they should be, but he has had a shocking blow. Sometimes he is positively humble with me, diffident and, as it were, apologetical, as though detected in false pretences, while with others he is cold, reserved, and on occasion arrogant, so unlike his usual open, friendly candour. And a relapse would not surprise me. At present, now that he can defecate with ease, his greatest difficulty is maintaining the dogged mechanical cheerfulness intended to show the American officers that he does not mind it, that he can lose as well as win. I have seen him succeed to admiration when taken by the French. But here the case is altered. These gentlemen are Americans, and the Java was the third frigate their little navy has taken, without a single victory to set off against the defeats. They are indeed a gentlemanly set, with one or two exceptions, for I cannot think highly of those who squirt tobacco juice past my ear, however skilfully, but they would be more than human if they could conceal their cheerfulness, their sense of well-being, I might even say their perfect happiness at having defeated the first naval power on earth. And even if they could, there would be no hiding the rustic merriment of the ship's company, the jolly carpenters, the facetious men with the caulking irons." A gang of these jolly carpenters moved him over to windward so that they could get at a gaping wound in the deck, hitherto covered with a tarpaulin. Moved him quite gently. "Mind where you put your foot, squire. There are holes enough to fill a wagon." Plenty of holes, indeed. The ship had been filled with the sound of hammering ever since they left San Salvador, but he was so used to it by now that this fresh outburst close at hand did not interrupt his thoughts. A gentlemanly set. He recalled their extreme care that nothing belonging to the Java's officers should be lost or looted. He remembered a huge American midshipman appearing with his diary and Jack's sheaf of papers folded into it and asking, "Who the black book belonged to?" He not only still possessed his diary and his writing case, but every last handkerchief and pair of stockings bestowed upon him. Some of the givers now dead, alas, more than 3,000 miles astern. The word diary made him frown, but the perpetual streaming wake carried his thoughts along, or rather the succession of images, and against that churning whiteness he once again beheld the ceremony in San Salvador at which the American commanding officer, Commodore Bainbridge, had addressed all his captives who were in a fit state to hear him, stating that if they would give their word not to serve against the United States until they were duly exchanged, they might go straight home to England in 2 cartel ships. Then the more private ceremony at which General Hislop, in his own name and in that of Java's surviving officers, presented the Commodore with a handsome sword in acknowledgement of his kindness to the prisoners. A kindness that extended not only to their ordinary belongings, but even to the Governor's magnificent service of official plate, a circumstance that may have added to Hislop's eloquence. Diary. The word jagged at his consciousness, and he returned to consider it. He had given way to 2 dangerous indulgences in his time. Laudanum was one, the bottled fortitude, the nepenthe that had tided him over some of his worst times with Diana Villiers, and that had then turned into a tyrannical master. Diary-keeping was the other, a harmless and even a useful occupation for most, but unwise in an intelligence agent. To be sure, in most places the manuscript was encoded 3 deep, in a cipher so personal that it had baffled the Admiralty's cryptographers when he challenged them with a sample. Yet there were some purely personal parts in which he had used a simpler system, one that an ingenious, puzzle-solving mind with a knowledge of Catalan could make out, if he chose to spend the necessary labour. It would be labour lost, from the point of view of intelligence, since these sections dealt only with Stephen's passion for Diana Villiers over all these years. Yet even so, he was very, very unwilling that any other eye should see him naked, see him exposed as a helpless, tormented lover, a nympholept, furiously longing for what was beyond his reach, and even more unwilling that any man should read his attempts at verse, Catullus and water at the best. A very great deal of water, though the fire might perhaps be the same. Nescio, sed fieri, sentio et excrucio. He did not really fear that any important part could be deciphered, but it would have been wiser to toss the diary overboard, with a weight attached, as Chads had thrown the Java's signal book in its leaden covers, and General Hislop his dispatches. And although he valued it extremely, apart from anything else he often needed a portable, infallible artificial memory, he probably would have done so, if he had not had 7 amputations on his hands. A foolish slip. An intelligence agent should carry nothing that did not bear its apparent explanation on its face, nothing that could arouse suspicion of a code. He had not claimed the book until they were in San Salvador, and when he did so the Commodore asked him whether the book had anything to do with the Java's cipher or signals, or whether it was of a private nature. Mr. Bainbridge was sitting in the great cabin, obviously in considerable pain from his wounded leg, with Mr. Evans and a civilian beside him. And it appeared to Stephen that the 3 Americans looked at him very attentively when he assured the Commodore that the entries in the book were of a purely personal, medical, and philosophic nature.
"And what of these papers?"
asked Bainbridge, holding up the sheaf.
"Ah, those have nothing to do with me," said Stephen carelessly. "I believe Captain Aubrey's steward brought them aboard. One looks very like his commission."
He leafed through the diary and showed Mr. Evans various anatomical drawings, the alimentary tract of the sea elephant that covered 2 pages, the whale bird's oviducts, the flayed hand of a man suffering from calcification of the palmar aponeurosis, some dissected aborigines. Mr. Evans expressed his admiration. The civilian said,
"May I ask, sir, why the text appears to be disguised?"
"A personal diary, sir," said Stephen, "is best considered as a mirror in which a man may see himself. Few men, who set down their shortcomings with the utmost naked candor, would wish to have them read by others. A medical diary, recording the symptoms, sufferings, and treatment of named patients, must also be secret. Mr. Evans will support me when I say that secrecy, total discretion, is one of the most important duties of our profession."
"It is part of the Hippocratic Oath," said Mr. Evans. Stephen bowed and went on.
"And, lastly, It is notorious that the natural philosopher is extremely jealous of his discoveries. He wishes to have the credit of first publication, and he would no more share the glory of a newfound species than a naval commander would wish to share his capture of a ship. The argument went straight home, and the Commodore handed over the book. The civilian appeared somewhat less satisfied, however. Who was he? The consul? He was neither named nor explained. He said, "I believe you belonged to the Leopard, sir."
"Just so, sir," said Stephen, "and it was aboard her in the high southern latitudes that I made the greater part of these discoveries and these drawings."
He had the diary back, but although he retained it, he had in some degree taken against the book, and illogically he no longer set his private mind on paper as he had done for so many years. Apart from notes recording the appearance of various birds, his last entry was that of many days ago.
"Now I know what Jack Aubrey will look like when he is 65.
He had the diary back, yet an uneasiness remained. Had not the Americans been strangely ready to grant his request when he asked leave to accompany those patients who were too sick to be moved from the Constitution, Jack and the two quarter-gunners who had been buried at sea a week ago, the ship heaved to and her bell tolling as they went over the side? Had he put his head into a trap? What was the true nature of the passengers the ship was carrying from San Salvador to Boston? One was certainly a consular official, a foolish little man whose only care was his luxuriant whiskers, a tiny politician for whom the world might fall apart so long as the Republicans remained in power. The other two were Frenchmen, the first a small, subfusc, grey, middle-aged man with a liverish face who wore grey small clothes, the kind of stockings that Franklin had made fashionable in Paris many years before, and a blue-grey coat. He was almost never seen on deck, and when he was always being sick over the side, usually the windward side. The other was a tall, military-looking civilian, Pontet-Canet, who seemed at first sight to be as vain as the consular young man, even more loquacious and quite as silly. Yet Stephen was not sure. Nor was he sure that he had not seen Pontet-Canet in some other place. Paris? Barcelona? Toulon? If he had, then it was certainly without those jet-black whiskers. But he had seen so very many people, and there were innumerable tall, vain Frenchmen who dyed their hair and spoke with a strong Burgundian accent. A secret agent needed a prodigious memory. He also needed a diary to supply those inevitable gaps and failures. Stephen had recently been looking into the Bible that a Boston society had placed in his cabin, as in every other part of the ship, and he had fallen upon two verses that stuck in his memory: "The wicked fleeth where no man pursueth," and "The fall of a liar is as from the housetop." A secret agent was not necessarily wicked, but an undue portion of his life was necessarily a lie. Once again Stephen felt the sickened weariness rising up, and he was not sorry to hear Pontet-Canet's voice wishing him good day. The Frenchman messed in the gunroom, and he often engaged Stephen in conversation, speaking a fluent though curious and heavily accented English. Now, having dealt with the weather and the probable nature of their coming dinner, they spoke of America, of the New World, comparatively empty, comparatively innocent.
"You have been in the States before, sir, I collect," said Stephen. "I dare say you know the country and the people well?"
"Perfectly," replied Pontet-Canet, "and I was very well received, for when I arrived among them I spoke like them, I dressed like them, I bewailed to have no more wit than them, and I found that all they did was good.
"Sometimes I think of retiring there," said Stephen.
"Ah," said Pontet-Canet, looking at him sharply, "you would not object to the regime? You would not object on the national grounds?"
"Never in life," said Stephen. "Europe is so old, so tired, so wearisome, that one longs for the simplicity of—" He would have added, "the noble Huron, and for the vast range of unknown birds, mammals, reptiles, plants." But he had rarely finished a sentence when talking to Pontet-Canet, and now the Frenchman broke in with a strong recommendation of such a course. America was the golden age revived.
I myself was in the Connecticut, in the back grounds of this state, hunting savage turkeys with a veritable American farmer, and he held me the following discourse. In me, my dear sir, you see a happy man, if such is to be found under heaven. Everything you see about you comes from my own land. These stockings, my daughter knitted them. My shoes and clothes come from my herds, and these herds, with my poultry yard and my garden, provide a solid, simple nourishment. The taxes here are almost nothing, and so long as they are paid, we can sleep on both ears. There is Arcadian simplicity, eh?
Certainly, said Stephen. Pray, sir, did you find your turkeys?
Yes, yes, cried Pontécanet, and some grace quills. I was the one that shot them all. I was the best fusil of the party, and, I allow myself to say without forfantery, the best cook.
How did you dress them?
Sir?
How did you cook them?
The squirrels in Madeira, the turkey roast, and all round the table was heard, very good, exceedingly good. Oh, dear sir, what a glorious bit.
Please to describe the turkey's flight.
Pontécanet spread his arms, but before he could take to the air, Mr. Evans appeared. The other monsieur, in conference with the Commodore, needed an interpreter.
I hope Mr. Bainbridge is well, said Stephen.
Oh, yes, 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 said Mr. Evans. A little laudable pus, no more. The wound is healing very prettily. Some pain, of course, and some discomfort, but we must learn to put up with that without growing mean or snappish. A pause. They tell me we are nearing the edge of the stream, said the surgeon, and that presently we shall see green water to larboard and Cape Fear.
Ha! Said Stephen, the green water in with the land. How I hope that we shall also see a skimmer.
What is a skimmer?
It is one of your seabirds. It has a singular beak, the lower mandible being longer than the upper. With this, it skims the surface of the sea. I have always longed to see a skimmer.
I guess you must be a considerable ornithologist, Dr. Maturin. You made some uncommon drawings of the far southern birds in your journal, I recall. There were no birds on the pages Stephen had exhibited. Clearly the book had been studied for some time. Mr. Evans seemed quite unaware of his slip, however, and he now proposed that they should finish their game of chess, a match that had reached a desperately congested middle game, with almost all the pieces on the board, not one of which could be moved without the utmost peril.
By all means, said Stephen, but do you think it would be possible to play on deck? Then, while you attempt to delay your inevitable defeat, I may keep my eye upon the sea. I should be loath to miss my skimmer.
Mr. Evans looked doubtful, but said he would have a word with the officer of the watch. All is well, he said, coming back. Mr. Heath has every sympathy with your wish. If you want to see a skimmer, you may play chess in any part of the ship, he says, and he will give orders that you be told if skimmers appear. He thinks there is a fair chance once we are close in with the Cape and out of the blue water. Some minutes later he brought the board, saying, I love this game. Apart from anything else, it is agreeable to my sentiments as a citizen of a republic, since it always ends with the discomfiture of a king.
I, too, was a republican in the frothy pride of my youth, said Stephen, inspecting the position while an awning was being stretched to protect them from the sun. And had I been out of coats at the time, I should have joined you at Bunker Hill and Valley Forge and those other interesting spots. As it was, I cheered the taking of the Bastille. But with age I have come to think that, after all, a monarchy is best.
When you look about the world and view the monarchs in it, I do not refer to your own, of course, can you really maintain that the hereditary king cuts a very shining figure?
I cannot, nor is that to the point. The person, unless he be extraordinarily good or extraordinarily bad, is of no importance. It is the living, moving, procreating, sometimes speaking symbol that counts.
But surely mere birth without any necessary merit is illogical.
Certainly, and that is its great merit. Man is a deeply illogical being and must be ruled illogically. Whatever that frigid prig Bentham may say, there are innumerable motives that have nothing to do with utility. In good utilitarian logic, a man does not sell all his goods to go crusading, nor does he build cathedrals, still less does he write verse. There are countless pieties without a name that find their focus in a crown. It is as well, I grant you, that the family should have worn it beyond the memory of man. For your recent creations do not answer. They are nothing in comparison of your priest-king, whose merit is irrelevant, whose place cannot be disputed, nor made the subject of a recurring vote.
Six bells struck. The awning was finished. Mr. Evans said,
Good Dr. Maturin, you will not take it amiss if I point out that your priest-king is on the wrong square.
So he is, too, said Stephen.
And having put it right, he fell to studying the position again. While he did so, a shadow crossed the board. He made his move and looked up. It was Pontécanet, surveying the game with pursed lips and narrowed eyes. The oblique sunlight fell on his black whiskers, showing an odd rusty tinge beneath the dye, or perhaps caused by the dye.
Where had he seen the man before?
His eyes wandered beyond the whiskers, beyond Mr. Evans's bowed, cogitating head, swept the sea for skimmers, and returning, beheld Jack Aubrey. Jack kept out of the way of his captors as much as he decently could. The necessary cheerfulness was burdensome to him, far more burdensome than the truly shocking pain in his shattered arm. But now that he was well enough to come on deck, he could not decently sit moping in his cabin. He paused at the top of the ladder, and Stephen saw his keen gaze run round the horizon in search of a British man of war, preferably an exact match for the Constitution, ideally his own Acasta, though she only carried 18-pounders. Having searched in vain, he cast an automatic glance at the sails and the sky to windward, and walked aft to watch the game.
"I have moved, sir," said Mr. Evans, disguising his triumph in a tone of false meekness.
He had indeed. Stephen, intent upon his own attack, had overlooked that odious knight. Whatever he did, he must lose a piece, and against a player as strong as Mr. Evans, that must mean losing the game. Unless... He advanced a pawn.
"No, no," cried Pontécanet. "You must..."
"Hush," cried Evans, Jack, and Stephen. Pontécanet glared, particularly at Jack, sniffed, and walked away. But presently he was back, his fingers fairly itching to put the chessmen right. The pieces fell, a brisk massacre. The board was almost clear, and Evans, one piece and two pawns up, fell plump into the trap.
"Oh," cried he, striking his forehead, "a stalemate!"
"Morally you won," said Stephen. "But at least this time my king was not discomfited."
"What you should have done," cried Pontécanet, "was to take the fool."
Evans and Stephen were too busy telling one another how they had contrived to lose, each having an impregnable position, an invincible plan of attack, to pay much attention to the others. But they were soon obliged to do so. The tone had risen far beyond that of ordinary disagreement. It had risen to acrimony. And at the same time it had so increased in volume that the American officers who were on the quarter-deck looked round in surprise.
"I must insist that you have placed the pieces wrongly,"
said Jack again, in a strong voice, unaccustomed these many years to contradiction from any but admirals and his wife.
"The Queen's rook was here."
He tweaked the piece from the Frenchman's hand, and firmly leaning across him, put it down, not without some emphasis.
"Do you believe to bully me?" cried Pontécanet. "You damned rogue! By God, it will not be so. I'll overboard you like a dead cat. If I find you too heavy, I'll cling to you with hands, legs, nails, everything. My life is nothing to send such a dog to hell. Now, just now."
Fortunately, his words came tumbling so fast and in so very strange an accent that Jack did not understand much of what he said. And fortunately, as Stephen and Mr. Evans interposed, the quarterdeck filled for the solemn noonday observation of the sun, a ceremony as grave here as it was in the Royal Navy. And the moment Commodore Bainbridge decreed that the hour was 12, the uproar of all hands to dinner drowned all private dissension. Stephen and Evans led Jack below for the dressing of his arm, and made him lie down to rest before dining with the Commodore.
"Shall we save it, do you suppose?" asked Evans, as they returned to the open air. "I doubt it," said Stephen, "and sometimes I am much tempted to cut. It is this clammy heat that does so weigh against him, and of course the mental agitation. He will accept Mr. Bainbridge's invitations, his very kindly intended invitations, though it kill him."
"As for the heat," said Mr. Evans, "once we round Cape Hatteras and stand inshore for the stream, there will be no more of that. And as for the agitation, might not we add the inspissated juice of lettuce to our present measures? The pulse is light, quick, and irregular,
and there is an uncommon degree of nervous excitement and irascibility in spite of the apparent stoicism. Another such scene as this morning's may have very grave effects. Obnoxious fellow with his "what you ought to have done." I would not lose a game of chess to that man for the world. With no fever, no pain, no weakness, I found it hard enough to govern my tongue. In peacetime I should have kicked him. But war makes strange bedfellows.
A ludicrous exhibition, said Stephen.
Too ludicrous, perhaps. Perhaps too much of the excitable, passionate Frenchman whom no one would take seriously. With his foot on the top of the ladder, Stephen remembered where he had seen him before. It was at a little inn high above Toulon, much frequented by the greedier part of the French navy. A French officer, Captain Christier Palliere, had taken Jack and Stephen to dinner there during the Peace of Amiens, and this man, passing by their table, had spoken to Christier Palliere. Stephen remembered his Dijon accent. He was about to eat a coq au vin, and the rest of his party a rable de lièvre, and he had taken particular notice of Jack, who was speaking English.
"Do you see a skimmer, sir?"
asked Mr. Evans, blocked behind him.
"I doubt it," said Stephen.
They took several turns up and down past the repairing parties and the line of carronades, a neat line now, although two had broken trunnions and one had received a ball full in the muzzle, while many of their slides were deeply scored and wounded. If an English man of war were to appear, she would find that the Constitution already had several of her teeth drawn. But it was too early for much hope of that. The cruisers were much more likely to be off the Chesapeake, or Sandy Hook, or in Massachusetts Bay, at the entrance to Boston itself, for Boston was their destination. The Java may have been destroyed, but at least she had prevented the Constitution from going on to cruise in the Pacific, as she had intended, and obliged her to return to her home port to be overhauled. Boston was her port, and at Boston, unless the blockading squadron captured her, the future would begin. For this voyage was no more than a transition, a curious, long-continued present.
"That is Cape Fear," observed Mr. Evans, pointing, "and now you can see the division between the Gulf Stream and the ocean clearly. There, do you see the line running parallel with our own course, about a quarter of a mile away?"
"A noble headland," said Stephen, "and a most remarkably clear division. Thank you, sir, for pointing it out."
They paced on in silence. No skimmers, no birds of any kind. With his mind reverting to chess, Stephen said,
"Your republic, now, Mr. Evans, do you look upon it as one and indivisible, or rather as a voluntary association of sovereign states?"
"Well, sir, for my part, I come from Boston, and I'm a Federalist. That is to say, I look upon the Union as the sovereign power. I may not like Mr. Madison, nor Mr. Madison's war. Indeed, I deplore it. I deplore this connection with the French, with their Emperor Napoleon, to say nothing of the alienation of our English friends. But I see him as the president of the whole nation, and I concede his right to declare it, however mistakenly, in my name. Though I may add that by no means all of my Federalist friends in New England agree with me, particularly those whose trade is being ruined. Most of the other officers aboard, however, are Republicans, and they cry up the sovereign rights of the individual states. Nearly all of them come from the South."
"From the South, do they indeed? Now that may account for a difference I have noticed in their manner of speech, a certain languor, what I might almost term a lisping deliberation in delivery, not unmelodious, but sometimes difficult for the unaccustomed ear, whereas all that you say, sir, is instantly comprehensible."
"Why, sure," said Evans in his harsh, nasal, metallic bray, "the right American English is spoke in Boston, and even as far as Watertown. You will find no corruption there, I believe, no colonial expressions other than those that arise naturally from our intercourse with the Indians. Boston, sir, is a well of English, pure and undefiled."
"I am fully persuaded of it," said Stephen. "Yet at breakfast this morning, Mr. Adams, who was also riz in Boston, stated that hominy grits cut no ice with him. I have been puzzling over his words ever since. I am acquainted with the grits, a grateful pap that might, with advantage, be exhibited in cases of duodenal debility, and I at once perceived that the expression was figurative. But in what does the figure consist? Is it desirable that ice should be cut? And if so, why? And what is the force of with?"
After barely a moment's pause, Mr. Evans said, "Ah, there now, you have an Indian expression. It is a variant upon the Iroquois, cat no ice vis me. I am unmoved, unimpressed. Yes, sir. But speaking of ice, Dr. Maturin, have you any conception of the cold in Boston during the winter months? It may well do good to our patient's arm, but on the other hand, it may carry off the rest of him. Has he no other clothing but what I see? And you, my dear sir, have you cold weather garments?
I have not, nor has Captain Aubrey. In our earlier mishap, we lost all our possessions that we did not carry in our hands.
All of them, said Stephen, looking down as the piercing memory of his collection filled his mind.
But it is of no great consequence. In a few days we shall be exchanged, and for a few days Captain Aubrey and I can very well brave the northern blizzard in the manner of the Iroquois, or the noble Huron, wrapped in a blanket. And in Halifax, I understand, there is every commodity to be had, from fur hats to the ingenious paddles used for walking on the snow.
A shade of embarrassment crossed Mr. Evans's face. He coughed once or twice and said,
Are you not perhaps reckoning without your host, Dr. Maturin? Exchange is sometimes eternal slow with us, and your officials in Halifax do not always seem to be much brighter than officials in other parts of the world, nor more active at their work. Surely it would be wise to lay in flannel shirts and woolen drawers at least. They will always serve.
Stephen promised to bear what he said in mind, and indeed it was impossible for him not to do so. When the Constitution was north of the Chesapeake, a screeching northwester laden with snow and ice crystals stripped her to close-reefed topsails, and under these topsails alone she stood on, close-hauled, for Nantucket Island. Blue noses and red hands were the order of the day. So was an uncommon alacrity and good humour, superadded to the cheerfulness of victory, for these were home waters for half of the hands. Many of them hailed from Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, Salem, or New Bedford, and as they jumped to round in braces or to hail upon the bowlines, they laughed and called out to one another, in spite of the piercing cold and in spite of the fact that this was the most dangerous part of the voyage, since the Royal Navy was blockading Boston. All hands were in tearing spirits. They knew that they would have a hero's welcome as well as all the delights of home, prize money, and the diversions of Boston. And officers and men did all that superb seamanship could do to drive the ship onwards through the wicked gale. All hands, except of course for the prisoners of war, particularly Captain Aubrey. Although he knew very well that this wind must blow the British cruisers off the coast, he was perpetually on deck, chilled through and through apart from his burning arm, whose pain stabbed so hard from time to time that he was obliged to cling to the rail not to cry out or fall down. He was sick, grey, and weak. He repelled any attempt at help or kindness, any supporting arm, with a curtness that soon died away with any sympathy there might have been. And he stared through the squalls and the thick weather for the relief that never came. Not that there was much sympathy for him to lose, at least among the foremost hands. He was known to have commanded the Leopard, and the Leopard, that unhappy ship which had made the Chesapeake bring to in peacetime to take British seamen, alleged deserters, out of her, and which had fired into her, killing and wounding a score of Americans, stood for all they hated in the Royal Navy. The Northwester blew on, and the Constitution lay to under Cape Cod waiting for it to blow out, so that she could slip round into Massachusetts Bay and so home before the blockading squadron returned. Ice formed thick on the yards and rigging. Snow drove aboard by day and night. He stood there still, though he could hardly hold his telescope, nor see when he had it firm, a tall and wretched figure. Once an empty beef cask came alongside, instantly recognizable from its marks. It must have been thrown overboard from a British man of war within the last few days. The doctors ordered him below, but he repeatedly escaped their vigilance, and the day before the wind veered far enough into the north for the Constitution to round the point, her bowlines as taut as harp strings, the hands learnt with general indifference that the captain of the Leopard had been laid low with pneumonia.
"We must get him across at once," said Stephen, raising his voice.
The Constitution, home at last, was rapidly filling with friends and relations, and the increasing roar of New England voices, familiar and at the same time exotic, made it hard to hear.
"Perhaps that ship could be induced to come alongside, and then we could pass him across on a stretcher without the inevitable agitation and disturbance of a boat."
The ship in question was a cartel filled with English prisoners to be exchanged. She was bound for Halifax in Nova Scotia, there to pick up an equivalent number of Americans, and she would drop down the Charles River with the tide.
"I'm afraid we cannot bundle him across just like that," said Evans. "I must have a word with the First Lieutenant."
It was not the First Lieutenant who appeared, however, but the Commodore himself. He came limping in and said,
"Dr. Maturin, this matter of exchange is not in my hands. Captain Aubrey must be taken ashore, and he must stay there until the proper authorities have made their decision."
He spoke in a strong, authoritative voice, as though he had an unpleasant duty to perform, and as though the doing of it called for a harsher tone than was natural to him. During the voyage he had always been considerate and polite in his intercourse with Jack, though somewhat remote and reserved, perhaps because of the pain in his wounded leg, and this new tone filled Stephen with uneasiness.
"You must excuse me," said the Commodore. "There are 1,000 things that must be done. Mr. Evans, a word with you."
Mr. Evans came back.
"It is much as I feared," he said, sitting down by Stephen in the sick bay. "Although I know nothing officially, I collect that there is likely to be a long delay over the exchange of our patient."
He leaned forward and raised Jack's eyelid. No comprehension in that blank, unseeing gaze.
"If, indeed, he is to be exchanged at all."
"Have you any notion of why this should be so?"
"I believe it may have something to do with the Leopard," said Evans hesitantly.
"But Captain Aubrey had nothing to do with that disgraceful affair, that firing into the Chesapeake. The ship was under the command of another man. At that time, Aubrey was 5,000 miles away."
"It was not that affair I meant."
"No, but it seems that when he was in command of that wretched vessel... But you will forgive me. I must say no more. Indeed, I have no more to say. I have only heard rumors to the effect that someone, somewhere, seems to have taken exception to his conduct. A misunderstanding, no doubt. But he is likely to be detained until it is cleared up."
Jack's noisy, labored breathing stopped. He raised himself, called out,
"Laugh and touch her!"
and fell back. Stephen and Evans heaved him up on his pillows, and each took a pulse. They exchanged a look and a confident nod. The patient's heart was bearing up to admiration.
"What is the best course to follow?" asked Stephen.
"Well now," said Evans, considering, "most of your officers put up at O'Reilly's hotel on parole. The men are kept in the barracks, of course. But that would not do in the present case, and I cannot conscientiously recommend the new hospital. The plaster is scarcely dry on its walls, and I would not see even a simple pneumonia, affecting no more than the apex of the right lung, subjected to those unwholesome damps. On the other hand, my brother-in-law, Otis P. Choate, who is also a medical man, has a small private establishment that he calls the Asclepia in a dry, healthy location near Beacon Hill."
"What could be more eligible? Would you know the nature of his terms at all?"
"They are very moderate. They are obliged to be very moderate, for I must tell you frankly, sir, that my brother-in-law is a man with strong notions of his own, and his Asclepia is not a paying proposition. Otis P. Choate is a good, sound physician, but he riles his fellow citizens. For one thing, he is opposed to alcohol, slavery, tobacco, and war. All wars, including Indian wars. And I must warn you, sir, that most of the attendants he employs are Irish women. Papists, I regret to say. And although, for my part, I have not noticed the drunkenness and profligacy associated with that unhappy pack of barefoot savages, and although the majority of them speak English of a sort, and at least seem clean, the circumstance has, of course, made the Asclepia unpopular in Boston. So it is filled, as far as it is filled at all, with lunatics whose friends do not choose to keep them at home, rather than with the medical and surgical cases for whom it was designed. It is commonly called Choate's Madhouse, and people affect to say that with such nurses and such a physician, no one can tell the odds between the patients and their attendants. I put this fairly before you, Dr. Maturin, because I am aware that some people might object to such an establishment."
"I honour your candour, sir," said Stephen, "but—"
"Never mind, Maturin," said Jack,
suddenly speaking in a deep, hoarse voice out of some partially lucid interval.
"He is an Irish papist himself. Ha, ha, ha! Drunk as a lord every morning by 9 o'clock, and never a shoe to his name."
"Is that so, sir?"
whispered Mr. Evans, looking more wretched and distressed than Stephen would have thought possible. For in general, the Constitution's surgeon, a man of somewhat formal, even ceremonious manners, presented a calm and impassive face to the world, an expression of grave, benign dignity.
I had no idea. I was not aware. Your sobriety, your... But apologies can only make the blunder worse. I beg you will forgive me, sir, and believe that no personal reflection was intended.
Stephen shook him by the hand and said that he was sure of it, but Mr. Evans found it difficult to recover his composure, and eventually Stephen said,
Dr. Choate's Asclepia sounds almost ideal.
Yes, said Mr. Evans, yes, yes. I will go and speak to the Commodore at once, and ask for his permission for the removal. He, of course, is responsible for your custody, for the production of your bodies on demand. I have no authority in the matter.
A short pause in which Stephen took a blanket from an empty cot and wrapped it round his shoulders against the damp and penetrating cold, and Evans returned.
All is well, he said. I found the Commodore very busy, surrounded with officials and people from the Yard, as well as half Boston's leading citizens. He merely called out, Do as you think fit, caught up this, showing a small packet, and desired me to deliver it to you.
Stephen read the hastily written note wrapped about the banknotes.
Commodore Bainbridge presents his compliments to Captain Aubrey, begs he will accept the enclosed to bear his charges ashore for the time being, hopes to have the pleasure of seeing him fully recovered very soon, and asks his pardon for not waiting on him at present. He flatters himself that Captain Aubrey, from long experience, will understand the many preoccupations that attend the docking of the ship.
This is exceedingly handsome in the Commodore, he said, a most gentlemanlike, elegant gesture. I accept it for my friend with the utmost pleasure.
We are all subject to the fortune of war, said Mr. Evans, visibly embarrassed as he produced a smaller packet. You will not, I am sure, condemn me to being behindhand with my shipmates. Come, sir, I do not need to tell you that there is a generosity in acceptation, and it is, alas, no more than 20 pounds.
Stephen acknowledged Evans's kindness, accepted his loan, and said all that was proper with real gratitude, for not only did the action please him extremely, but he did not in fact possess a single coin of any kind, great or small, and he had been wondering how the terms of Choate's madhouse could be met, however moderate they might prove to be.
"You said 20 pounds, Mr. Evans," he remarked,
after they had been talking for some time about the apex of Jack's right lung, enomata, and the care of the mentally deranged.
"Is it usual, in your country, to use the old names for money?"
"We often speak of pennies and shillings," said Evans, "sometimes of pounds, but far more rarely. I caught the habit from my father when I was a boy. He was a Tory, a loyalist, and even when he came back from Canada and learnt to live with the Republic, he never would give up his pounds and guineas."
"Were there many loyalists in Boston?"
"No, not a great many. Nothing to compare with New York, for example. But still we had our sheep, black or white, according to your point of view. Perhaps 1,000 out of some 15,000, which is what I reckon the town held at that time."
"A desperate state of affairs it must be, when a man finds himself torn between conflicting loyalties. Tell me, did you ever hear of a Mr. Herapath?"
"George Herapath? Oh, yes, indeed. He was a friend of my father's, a fellow Tory. They were in exile together in Canada. He is quite a prominent citizen. He always was, being a considerable shipowner and trading with China more successfully than most. And now that the Federalists and the old Tories have come together, he is more important still."
"I am a child in American politics, Mr. Evans," said Stephen, "and cannot readily see how the Federalists and Tories can have come together, since, as you so kindly explained to me, the Federalists maintain the sovereignty of the Union, of the state, as opposed to the states."
"What brings them together is a common dislike for Mr. Madison's war. I am betraying no secrets when I say that this war is unpopular in New England. Everybody knows it, and although there are no doubt higher motives, money speaks in Boston, whether you call it dollars and cents or pounds, shillings and pence. And the merchants are being ruined. Their foreign trade is strangled, sir, strangled. But the Republicans?"
What the Republicans were about, Stephen never learnt, for the Constitution's starboard timbers uttered a long, concerted groan as she eased up against the wharf.
"We are alongside, gentlemen," said the First Lieutenant, looking into the sick bay. "I've laid on a slave for Captain Aubrey. We aim to shift him in half an hour, and Dr. Choate sends to say that all will be ready, sir."
"Strangled, sir," said Mr. Evans, when they were alone again. "George Herapath, for example, has 3 fine barks tied up here, and 2 more at Salem. His China trade is at a stand."
"Mr. Herapath has a son. Young Michael?"
"Yes, a sad disappointment to him, I'm afraid, and to all his friends.
He was bright enough as a boy. He was at our Latin school with my nephew Quincy, and he studied hard. Then he learnt Chinese, and it was thought he would be a great help to his father in business. But no, he went off to Europe and became a rake, and what some people think much worse, a spendthrift. I am told he has come back from his travels bringing a drabble-tail with him, a wench from Baltimore, a Romanist. Not, he cried, that I mean the least connection, my dear sir. I only mean to emphasize Mr. Herapath's misfortune, he being a staunch Episcopalian.
Ah, gentlemen, said Stephen, I met Michael Herapath in his travels. Indeed, he acted as my assistant for a while. I valued him much, and hope I may see him again.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear, said Mr. Evans. I seem fated to move from one blunder to another today. I shall hold my tongue for what remains of it.
Where would conversation be if we were not allowed to exchange our minds freely and to abuse our neighbours from time to time, said Stephen.
Very well. It is very well. But I shall go and borrow a buffalo robe for Captain Aubrey's journey, and say no more. The sleigh will be here at any moment now.
Stephen was pleased with the Asclepia. It was dry, clean, and comfortable, and the kind, gentle Irish voices made him feel that the pervading warmth must come from turf fires. He could almost have sworn he caught that exquisite, home-like scent. He was pleased with Dr. Choate as a physician, pleased with the design of the establishment and its many private rooms, its domestic air. Dr. Choate's care and treatment of his many half-wits and lunatics was as far removed as possible from the chains, whipping, bread-and-water, barred cell usage that Stephen had so often seen, and so often deplored. Yet it might be that he carried the open-door principle a little too far. More than once Stephen had seen a potentially dangerous case wandering about the lower corridors, muttering or standing rigid, motionless in a corner. But for Dr. Choate's ordering of his sick rooms, Stephen had nothing but praise. These were in the central block, and Jack's was a fine, light, airy place, with a view over the little town to the navy yard and the harbour. This central block, whether it was on purpose or by chance, seemed to be arranged in an ascending order of cheerfulness. The rooms on either side of Jack's were occupied by the few surgical or medical cases in a fair way to mending, and not far from them were those patients in the mildly exalted or elevated phase of the folie circulaire. They met in a common sitting-room, where they played cards, sometimes for several $100,000,000, or played music, often surprisingly well. Dr. Choate himself joined them with his oboe whenever he could, observing that he looked upon it as his most valuable therapeutic instrument. There were, of course, the usual heart-breaking melancholias, people who had committed the unpardonable sin, had done the everlasting wrong, others whose families were poisoning their food, or who were going about to do them evil by means of Indian smoke, a woman whose husband had put her to a dog, and who sobbed and sobbed, never sleeping and never to be consoled. There were the senile dementias, and mad paralysed syphilitics, and the nasty idiots, the despair of the world. But they were on the lower floors and in the wings. Jack saw none of this. He was in the cheerful part, and this was appropriate, for superficially he was himself a cheerful patient. His arm, though still painful in some places and numb in others, was almost certainly saved. He had recovered from his pneumonia, and he had learnt of the Americans' reverses in their attack upon Canada. The army had done well, and to some extent that was a compensation for the navy's failure. He was still weak, but he ate voraciously. Clam chowder, Boston beans, cod, anything that came his way.
"My dear," he wrote to Sophie, "you know I've always wanted to imitate Nelson, except in the marital line, as much as ever I can, and here I am dashing away with my left hand, and writing much the same kind of scrawl as he did. But in a month or so Dr. Choate tells me I may try the right. Stephen says he is a very clever fellow."
Clever, yes, and most unusually kind. Stephen admired his learning, his skill in diagnosis, and his wonderful handling of his lunatics. Choate could often bring comfort to those who seemed so deeply sunk in their own private hell as to be beyond all communication, and although he had some dangerous patients, he had never been attacked. Choate's ideas on war, slavery, and the exploitation of the Indians were eminently sound. His way of spending his considerable private means on others was wholly admirable, and sometimes, when Stephen was talking to Choate,
he would consider that earnest face with its unusually large, dark, kindly eyes, and wonder whether he was not looking at a saint. At other times a spirit of contradiction would rise, and although he could not really defend poverty, war, or injustice, he would feel inclined to find excuses for slavery. He would feel that there was too much indignation mingled with the benevolence, even though the indignation was undeniably righteous, that Dr. Choate indulged in goodness as some indulged in evil, and that he was so enamoured of his role that he would make any sacrifice to sustain it. Choate had no humour, or he would have never linked drink and tobacco to issues so very much more important. Stephen liked his glass of wine and his cigar, and he was certainly guilty of deliberate meekness on occasion. Perhaps there was some silliness there. Might it be that silliness and love of one's fellow men were inseparable? These were unworthy thoughts, he admitted. He also admitted that he would rely implicitly upon Choate's diagnosis rather than his own, and Choate was more hopeful than he about Jack's arm. Jack's letter crept on.
I shall send this by Bulwer of Belvedere, who was caught when one of her prizes was retaken and who is to be exchanged directly. He goes aboard the cartel that I can see from my window this evening. My exchange still seems to be hanging fire, though I cannot tell why, but I dare say it will come as soon as I am fit to travel, which will be in a week or two, at the prodigious rate I am gaining weight and strength. Bulwer has very kindly been coming to sit with me, and so have several other officers, and they have told me the most encouraging news about our successes in Canada. I expect him shortly, and must bring this sad scribble to a close, but before I seal it up I must tell you of another visitor I had today. He often looks in the most friendly, free and easy way, and so do many of the other patients, to ask me how I do. Indeed, this is a very free and easy place, not to say haphazard, quite unlike Haslar or any hospital I've ever seen. Visitors wander in and out as they please, and they are almost never announced. The one I am talking about is a fine, stout, rosy gentleman, the Emperor of Mexico, in fact, but here he only uses the title of Duke of Montezuma, and today he let me into a great secret, known to very few. The whole world has gone mad, it seems, but they are too far gone to know it. A kind of sudden epidemic caused by drinking tea. It began with our poor king, and then burst out with the American election, when President Madison was chosen. Now it covers the whole world, said he, laughing extremely and skipping. Even you, sir, even Captain Aubrey, ha, ha, ha. But he comforted me with a grant of 14,000 acres on the Delaware, and the fishing rights on both banks of the Gulf of Mexico, so we shall not go short of victuals in our old age. He and many of the others, do you see, are somewhat astray in their wits. Yet I have noticed a curious thing, which is that the sort I see, the patients that Dr. Choate lets wander about and gather in the parlour, are not nearly so much astray as they seem. Much of it is play. They are persuaded that I am one of them, that I only pretend to be a post-captain R.N. for fun, and so we humour one another, each playing at being madder than the next. And there are certain unspoken rules. Come in, he cried.
The door opened, and three men appeared. The first, a man in sad-coloured clothes with a large number of dull metal buttons, seemed to be all trunk, so very short were his legs, and those legs almost hidden by his long coat. His large, fat, glabrous face was pale and shining. His watery eye had the glare that was now so familiar to Jack. He wore his grey hair long. The other two were less striking, meagre fellows in black, but equally insane. He hoped they would not be tedious or lewd.
"Good afternoon, sir," said the first. "I am Jaleel Brenton, of the Navy Department."
Jack knew Jaleel Brenton quite well, a distinguished post-captain in the Royal Navy, an unusually religious man, a friend of Samaras and other blue-light admirals, had been made a baronet quite recently, born in America, hence the curious Christian name. He said,
"Good afternoon to you, gentlemen. I am John Aubrey, grandson to the Pope of Rome."
After a slight pause, Mr. Brenton said,
"I was not aware that Romanists were allowed in your service, sir."
"Never you believe it, sir. Why, half the Board of Admiralty is made up of Jesuits, though it don't do to let it be generally known. Pray take a seat. How is your brother Ned?"
"I have no brother Ned, sir," said Mr. Brenton crossly. "We are come here to ask you some questions about the leopard."
"Ask on, old boy," said Jack, laughing at his approaching wit. "All I know is, she can't change her spots. Ha, ha, ha! 'Tis in the Bible," he added, "and you can't say fairer than that."
A pause.
"What about the tiger? Should not we be happier with the tiger? I could tell you any number of tales about the tiger.
One of Jack's madder neighbours thrust his head in through the partly open door and cried, "Peepo!" Then, seeing that the captain had company, he withdrew it. The smaller, dark man whispered to Mr. Brenton, "Zeke Bates, the butcher," in a tone that quivered with horror. But after a moment, unable to resist, Mr. Bates slid his portly form through the crack, and with his finger to his lips, glided up to Jack's bedside, taking long, undulating steps. There he produced a butcher's knife, wrapped in a handkerchief, showed Jack how it would shave the hairs from his forearm, laid his finger to his nose, gave Jack a knowing private wink, and glided silently off again. The middle-sized dark man looked about, but finding no spittoon, he stepped to the window and squirted a stream of tobacco juice into the garden.
"You, sir,"
cried Jack, who disliked the habit extremely.
"Put that damned quid out of your mouth. Toss it out of the window, do you hear me? Close the window, sit down, and tell us what you know about the tiger."
The man tiptoed to his chair. Mr. Brenton wiped his glistening face and said, "It is not the tiger that is in question, Captain Aubrey, but the leopard. Is there a key to that door?" he cried, his eye on the gently moving handle.
"You surely do not think I'm going to allow myself to be locked in with you,"
said Jack, a cunning leer.
"No, there ain't."
"Mr. Winslow," said Brenton, "go put your chair against the door and sit on it. Now, sir, it is alleged that on or about 25th March last year, when in command of HBM ship Leopard, you fired upon the American brig Alice B. Sawyer. What have you to say to that?"
"I confess all," cried Jack. "I shifted backstays, I slept out of my ship, I kept false musters, I failed to submit my quarterly returns, I allowed stove casks to be thrown overboard, and I blasted Alice B. Sawyer from the water with both my broadsides treble-shotted. I throw myself upon the mercy of this honourable court."
"Note that," said Brenton to one of his assistants. "Then, Captain Aubrey, do you recognise these papers?"
"Of course I do," said Jack in an ordinary voice. "The one is my commission, and the others? Let me have a look at them."
They looked very like the packets that Admiral Drury had asked him to take home, together with some of his own victualling notes. The smaller, dark man brought the sheaf, and Jack, who had noticed that he was writing, plucked the notebook from his hand and read, "The prisoner, apparently in liquor, acknowledges that he is Captain Aubrey, states that he is a Roman Catholic, and makes similar allegations about the British Board of Admiralty. Admits that when in command of the Leopard, he fired both broadsides at the brig Alice B. Sawyer." The door gave a sudden jerk, butting against Winslow's chair. Winslow leapt up with a tremendous howl. The door opened wide, and Mr. Bulwer of the Royal Navy appeared.
"Bulwer," cried Jack, "I'm delighted to see you. Now, gentlemen, you must excuse me. There is an urgent letter that I must finish."
"Not so quickly, Captain Aubrey, not so quickly, if you please," said Mr. Brenton. "I have a whole raft of questions yet. You, sir," to Bulwer, "you may wait in the lobby." Jack had made an awkward movement in shaking Bulwer's hand. His arm hurt damnably. The peevishness of convalescence rose in a sudden tide, and in any case these were dreary lunatics, not nearly so quick or lively as Butcher Bates. Sir Jaleel Brenton was not a patch on the Emperor of Mexico, and this was a dreary game. He was tired of it.
"Mr. Bates there," he cried. "Friend Zeke! Brother Zeke!"
The huge, mad, glowing face instantly showed at the door, excited, all alive, growing rather wild, a white line of spittle between its grinning lips.
"Good Mr. Bates, pray show these gentlemen the door. Show them the way to Mrs. Kavanagh. She will give them all a comfortable, warm draught."
"Jack," said Stephen, coming in with a parcel, "I have bought us woolen undergarments, just one set apiece. The winter is passing fast, and bonnets with flaps to protect the ears." "Why, Jack, what's amiss?"
"I must tell you some damned bad news," said Jack. "Did you hear the bands playing all over the town, and the people cheering this afternoon?"
"How could I miss it? I thought they were celebrating the capture of the Java all over again. It was much the same din, with three bands playing Yankee Doodle and three Salem Heroes Rise and Shine."
"They were celebrating a victory, true enough, but it was a different victory, a fresh victory. Their Hornet has sunk our Peacock, engaged her off the Demerara River and sunk her in 14 minutes.
"Oh," said Stephen.
There was a curious stab at his heart. He had not known how much he felt for the Navy.
"You may say what you like," went on Jack in a flat, dogged voice. "You may say their Hornet,
You remember her, Stephen? The little ship sloop that was lying in San Salvador? That their Hornet had a 297-pound broadside and the Peacock only 192? But it is still a very bad business. To sink her in 14 minutes! They killed young Billy Peake, too, and knocked out 37 of his men, as against only 3 Americans. No wonder they are thumping on their drums. And anyhow, the whole point of war is to bring more guns to bear on your enemy than he can bring to bear on you, or to point them better. The whole point is to win. It is not a game. Bulwer brought the news, so upset he could hardly speak, and he showed me this paper.
Stephen looked at it. A card addressed to Captain Lawrence of the Hornet by the 5 surviving officers of the Peacock, and reproduced by the Boston newspaper. We ceased to consider ourselves prisoners, and everything that friendship could dictate was adopted by you and the officers of the Hornet to remedy the inconvenience we would otherwise have experienced from the unavoidable loss of the whole of our property and clothes owing to the sudden sinking of the Peacock.
He said, I am sure that what they say is very true, but it makes a somewhat abject publication.
Jack stared out of the window. He could see the American men of war down there, dressed all over for the victory, and it was only by the grace of God that he did not see the American flag flying over the British. The Peacock lay in 5 fathom water in the mouth of that distant river, the Guerriere and Java at the bottom of the Atlantic, and the Macedonian was in New York. He thought of elaborating his ideas on the nature of war, on the change that had come over the Navy since Nelson's time, the wanton stupidity of the administration, the overconfidence of well-connected commanders, the goddamned spit and polish. A whole series of reflections that had filled his mind for a great while now, but he was too weary, too low. He said,
Oh, there was another damn thing that happened today. Some officials from their Navy Department came to see me. They were not announced, and I thought they were just some more of our lunatics, particularly their leader, a Dutch-built civilian with a wall eye. And when he said he was Jaleel Brenton, I was sure of it. So I humoured them and played the fool with their questions until Bulwer came, and then I put them out, because I wanted to finish a letter to Sophie for Bulwer to take.
You gave him my parcel, I trust? Asked Stephen. He was speaking of his diary, packed, sealed, and addressed to Sir Joseph Blaine at the Admiralty, together with a covering note to his colleague in Halifax.
Oh, yes. I could not forget your parcel. I wrote my letter on it, and when I watched Bulwer going aboard, through my glass I noticed he had it under his arm. It was he who told me they really had a Jaleel Brenton, a man who has to do with the exchange of prisoners. Apparently the name is quite usual in these parts. Our Brenton came from Rhode Island, I believe.
What was the nature of their questions?
They wanted to know whether the Leopard had fired on an American merchantman to bring her to, the Alice B. Sawyer, as I recall. I don't think we did, but I should have to look at the log, to be sure. And then they wanted me to explain some papers I had wrapped up in my commission, victualling notes as far as I recollect, and some private letter the Admiral asked me to carry home.
They sat there in the gathering twilight. Sounds of rejoicing and the occasional roar and crack of a rocket reached them through the window, and at last Jack said,
Do you remember Harry Whitby, who had Leander in the year 6? You treated him for some complaint or other.
Stephen nodded.
Well, when he was off Sandy Hook, he fired to bring some American merchantmen to see whether they had any contraband aboard. A man was killed, or died, or at all events lost the number of his mess. Whitby swore it was not Leander's fault, because her shot passed a full cable's length ahead of the American's bows. However, the Americans swore it was, and they moved heaven and earth to have him brought to trial for murder in their own country. It seems that the ministry even thought of handing him over, but in the end they only had him court-martialed. He was acquitted, of course, yet to pacify the Americans he was never given another ship, not for years and years. He was on shore, unemployed, until in some way he came by proof that the man had not in fact been killed by Leander's fire. Now it occurs to me that they might be trying the same kind of caper in this case, but in this case there is no question of their having to persuade government to hand me over. I am here.
Such inveterate malignance, brother? I find it hard to credit. I do not believe you made any American ship stop this last voyage at all.
Oh, I dare say it is only because I am hipped. The blue devils put such ideas into your mind. But still it would explain the delay in exchanging me. And then again they hate the very name of Leopard, naturally enough. I am connected with her, and any stick will do to hang a wicked dog. The American sailors we have met are good seamen, brave fellows, and generous to a fault. I should never suspect them of anything like that.
But these civilians, these officials...
"Lord, they're sitting in the dark, the creatures," cried Bridie Donahue. "Doctor, there's a lady for you. Will I light the lamp now?"
Through the open door, from some way away, came the sound of a laugh, a gurgling laugh, intensely amused, that went on and on. They both smiled quite involuntarily, but then Jack, sinking back, said,
"That is Louisa Wogan. I should have known that laugh anywhere. But, Stephen, I could not cope with visitors just now. Pray be a good fellow and make my compliments and excuses, will you?"